Yes, sure, I come to order. Today is February 26, 2009. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2476.
House Bill 2476 enhances the penalty for sex abuse in the second degree when the offender is age 21 or older and the minor victim's athletic coach. It also expands the definition of sex abuse to include sexual contact when the offender is 21 or older and is the minor victim's athletic coach. We do not yet have a fiscal statement on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Winger, thank you for bringing this bill to the committee, and please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, you have before you a bill that has, in the end, both fiscally and within the legislative and the judicial process, probably very little impact. We're not talking about a very large group of folks who are going to fall into the changes in this bill, but we think it's important. And what we're talking about is athletic coaches who are involved in inappropriate sexual contact with their athletes. This came to my attention because of a constituent, Ray Thomas, who educated me about the fact that one could be involved in an incident like this and not get any jail time. So after some long conversations, what we decided to do was to craft a bill that would focus on just that, that this is such a meaningful and egregious crime for the person that it happens to. And it is such a specific betrayal of trust because of the relationship that athletic coaches have with their athletes, and Ray's going to talk about that, that it's important that there be a presumption of some actual jail time. So, and others will talk about it, but we're talking about a minimum of 16 months. I had passed out to the committee just a basic LexisNexis search of cases that involve coaches and athletes. And just to be clear, in many of these cases, the crime is sufficiently severe enough that there will be jail time involved in these charges. I'm not passing these out as cases in which the person isn't likely to get jail time, but more just to give the idea of the fact that this has become, unfortunately, while not a pervasive crime, it happens with some regularity. And the thing about this crime is it always gets attention, and I think for good reason, because it is such a serious violation of trust. So I hope that the members of the committee will give this bill some very serious attention. One of the more recent ones just this week. I mean, I certainly didn't plan any of the news events, but as those of you who've been following it know that unfortunately, with some regularity, we are having to deal with this issue of athletic coaches and their athletes. And I think it's important that as a legislature, we send a very strong message about how we feel about this and that we get in front of it before it does become something that happens too frequently. And I'll turn it over to Ray to tell his story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Ray Thomas. I live at 37395 Southwest Blooming Fernhill Road in Cornelius, Oregon. I'm one of Representative Winger's constituents. I hope that you never have to appear here to talk about something that is as personal to you and your family as what brings me here. But last summer, my 14-year-old had been honored by having been selected for training by an elite track coach named Askia Brown in Portland, who was a track coach with Central Catholic High School and with the Portland Track Club. When that happened, our family was honored that he would think that she had sufficient talent to merit that type of attention at that level. But before we allowed her to become one of his track athletes, we checked him out on Google, we talked to other track parents, and I interviewed him. And he seemed to be somebody who was basically at the top of the track prep scene in Oregon. 3 weeks into this coaching, and as part of a workout, he told my daughter that she needed to have a post-workout massage to make it so that she would have the maximum impact of the workout. And what happened was that he sexually abused her when this supposed sports massage occurred. He was taken into custody, and the case that resulted in sex abuse 2 and 3 charges was covered by the Portland Press. And several other athletes who had been coached by this guy came forward and described their experiences with him, which were somewhat along the same lines. Two athletes came forward and also leveled similar charges against him, and he's now facing 3 charges of sex abuse 2 and 3 in Multnomah County Circuit Court. And the reason that I'm here today is that after these charges were initiated, I found out that under Oregon's sentencing structure, he is going to get, even if he's convicted of all of 3 of these, against these 3 girls and their families, a presumptive sentence of probation. And having gone through this, experienced this firsthand, I can tell you that a coach is in a special position relative to their athletes. How often do you parents allow your kids to go into the company of some adult where you look on approvingly when the adult yells at them, pushes them beyond their limits? And for a young athlete who's in a coach-athlete relationship, one of the first stages of really becoming an excellent athlete is to trust your coach to do for you what you need to do, even if it involves pain, to make yourself the best athletic performer that you can. And when that trust is violated, I can tell you that the effect upon the athlete is devastating. And so I felt like these, because of the way the Oregon statutory structure works, these charges of sex abuse 2 and 3, a Class C felony and a Class A misdemeanor, when you look at what the end result is, and Darian Stan from the Multnomah DA's office is going to show you how it works out with the sentencing standards, the fact is that it is not a fair result where somebody who's given this level of trust can go through and conduct the type of damage that was put upon my daughter, these other athletes, and these other athletes that you've learned about in the packets, and walk through this experience with a probation sentence. And I feel that if this legislature passes these enhanced sentences, we're not talking about a great number of people who are going to be entering the system with a costly disposition, but what we are going to do is to send a message to the schools, to the athletes, to the coaches, so that in their continuing education, what they're going to learn about is that there is a special recognition of that position of responsibility by coaches, and that if they cross the line, they're going to get hammered for it. And if somebody does do it, so that it's not a situation where they can do something like this and commit this type of a despicable act upon a impressionable young person and get a sentence of probation for it. So I appreciate it if you would take a serious look at this and help, if you think it's the right thing, to make it into Oregon law. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Darian Stanford. I'm with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I am here today for a variety of reasons. First and foremost is to express the support of District Attorney Mike Shrunk and Multnomah DA for House Bill 2476. Staff was kind enough to distribute a letter from Mr. Shrunk. I'm not going to take the time to read it to you all. It's there. There's also another letter that was distributed from a person by the name of Annie McIntyre. She is a young woman who excelled at Oregon Athletics and then went on, is playing this weekend her final collegiate game at Manhattan. And she was coached by Howard Avery, who has been getting a lot of attention in the news recently. She had some comments that she wanted to make. Again, you can look at the letter yourself. She would like to be here, but she is playing her last game this weekend in New York. And then there are two other documents that I distributed. And those documents are, first of all, is Oregon Sentencing Guidelines Grid, which is something that I assume that all of you are familiar with to some capacity. It's the chart that looks sort of like this. I'll only talk briefly about that. And then the last thing is another grid that I developed on my own. It's got some color to it, not as much as the other document. It's entitled Oregon Felony Sex Offenses Involving Victims 18 and Under. And this is for your information to try to understand what it is exactly that we're talking about and what it is precisely the conduct that House Bill 2476 is meant to address. If you look at this, let me address this bill for this in just a second. House Bill 2476, as committee counsel said, does two things. Section 1 takes the crime of sex abuse 2, which is a felony. It's right now at crime level 7 on the sentencing guidelines grid. If a sex abuse 2 is committed by a coach towards an athlete under the coach's control in some capacity, that elevates it to a level 8. I'll talk more about that in 1 second. Section 2 of the bill takes sex abuse 3, which is a misdemeanor right now, and if that is committed by a coach, that elevates it to a level 7 sex abuse 2. So that's what the bill does. What is it that we're talking about? If you can consult the chart that I did, I want to be clear about what it is, the conduct that we're referring to. Sex abuse 2 is essentially intercourse, anal sex, oral sex, or any sort of penetration, and the victim is between the ages of 14 and 17. Ballot Measure 11 does not reach those ages unless there's force, or relations, or mental incapacity in some sorts. So what we're talking about is intercourse, anal sex, oral sex, or penetration, and the victim is between the ages of 14 and 17. That crime is sex abuse 2. Right now, that crime is classified as a level 7 on Oregon's sentencing guidelines grid. And as I've mentioned, House Bill 2476 moves that to a level 8. Why is that significant? What we're doing is shifting the presumption for certain classes of offenders. At level 7, people that have no criminal history or people that have as many as 3 non-person felonies, level 7 means that their presumed sentence is probation. At a level 8, the presumed sentence, regardless of your criminal background, is prison. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to always get prison. You can depart from that, but the presumption is shifted to prison rather than probation. So that's what Section 1 of the bill does. Section 2 of the bill goes into the crime of sex abuse 3. Sex abuse 3 is very different from sex abuse 2. Sex abuse 3 is about sexual contact. Basically, any sort of sexual activity that falls short of what I previously discussed. Touching, if you will. Sex abuse 3 for a victim ages 14 to 17 is right now a Class A misdemeanor. So it doesn't even fall on the grid at all. If the perpetrator is a coach, sex abuse 3 would move from a Class A misdemeanor to a level 7 felony. That is a lot of information in a very short period of time. I know that you all have a very busy agenda today. I'm happy to answer any other specific details if you have
any. Any questions? Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to thank the panel and Mr. Thomas. I suspect I speak for all of us. I deeply appreciate your courage in bringing this forward in a public light. It's appreciated by all. I very much support the idea, the fact that there is presumptive probation for this kind of conduct is not acceptable, and I support the intent to change it. I do have a question. Frankly, I'm wondering why we're limiting it to coach, as opposed to teacher or family member. And I know you talked a lot about, for example, frequency of the conduct, also the level of trust and sort of special relationship there. But that does not strike me as unique to coach. Indeed, I suspect family members, relatives, etc., is probably the most frequent occurrence, I'm just guessing, in the world. And I'm wondering what we can do. Is this bill going far enough? Is it simply a recognition of fiscal realities that we've limited it to coach?
Well, I can tell you that we thought about that, and this was what we experienced and felt like while a family member is somebody who can sure cause a lot of terrible damage to a young person, a coach is in a unique position in that they kind of come in and traditional boundaries disappear real fast. And fiscal realities were a real consideration in my mind because I didn't want to place us in a position where we were coming to you and somebody would take a look at the numbers and say, but how can we afford this? In these cases, and the cases that Representative Wingert collected for you, the numbers are not that high. The level of damage and the impact is really high, but the numbers are not. And frankly, I felt like while I wouldn't think that it would be a bad idea, I think it's a good idea to expand it, we have to recognize some fiscal realities, and I hope that to the extent that it was going to make a difference down the road, making it narrow might make it more likely that we could take care of this problem now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, as Ray said, we had a discussion about just a sentence enhancement for the crime, and what we really focused on, though, and as my constituent, you know, what I tried to get Ray focused on was this particular issue. And I think the more we talked about it, the more we believed that there is an issue with athletic coaches and that we wanted to be specific with that. And Darren can speak to this, but from our discussions, we believe we're talking about less than 10 cases a year in which we would be moving from a presumptive probation to a jail sentence. So the idea was really to focus on, to be very specific, and to focus on this particular type of illegal behavior.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, in terms of actual numbers, and this is an estimate from Multnomah County only, that's all I can speak for, the estimate that we provided to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission is one offender limited to coach. We're talking about perhaps one offender a year. With a more expansive definition of persons in a position of trust or authority, we're talking about perhaps 10. That's Multnomah County.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Wingert or anyone else, I just think that the fact that there's presumptive probation for a sex abuse, too, is something we need to look at. And apologies to Representative Shields, whose budget this might influence. But in another time, in another fiscal environment, that's something I'd look forward to working with someone on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thomas, I appreciate your testimony. I really, I've got a 10-month-old daughter now and can really feel for your situation, perhaps in ways that I wouldn't have 11 months ago, even though you try to be as empathetic as possible. You know, one of the things that we're kicking around is trying to figure out how we can look at sentencing policies kind of as a broader package, and because budgeting, unfortunately, is very much a zero-sum game. And I was just wondering if there was a way that we could find a way to de-emphasize sentencing somewhere else in order to move this forward. Would you be open to that?
Chair Barker and Representative Shields, I appreciate you asking me that, but you're now way beyond my level in terms of what is the next best move. And I have to say, if you believe that this is a good idea, I have to trust your leadership on how best to move it forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there are some bills coming from the Senate that have teachers included, and there's teacher licensing. One of the problems that I think this addresses is the people who are coaches who aren't really teachers, and they kind of have been in this netherland out there, and we see the results of that where they're, you know, they can go get a different job. I mean, maybe somebody will say, we're hearing you have a problem, and they can zip away because people don't want to, the families don't want to get involved, you know, and so on. So this is an attempt to take care of that. I think everybody's concerned, and there is certainly fiscal problems, the public wants safety. The public wants their kids protected. and we need to look at that as well. So, and if you may have heard, Mr. Thomas, that our fiscal isn't ready, that means we can't move the bill forward today. But we thank the panel for your presentation, especially thank you for bringing this forward. You know how tough that is on people. But you put a human face on it, which is very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hazara, Debbie in, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairs, Vice Chairs. My name is Greg Hazara-Bedian. I am the public defender in Lane County. I'm also the president of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It is that hat I wear before you this afternoon. OCDLA opposes this bill, but not for reasons that I think would offend Mr. Thomas. Our sympathies certainly go out to him and all other families who are victimized by people in the situation that he described, the abuser of his daughter. What OCDLA would like to point out to the committee is that there's already a mechanism for dealing harshly with people who abuse public trust or special relationship with a child. And those methods are found in the aggravating factors on your sentencing guideline grid, and that is a way to make a punishment more serious than the presumptive sentence. And two of the aggravating factors that can severely increase a punishment, I see Vice Chair Wisnant looking at the guidelines. It's on the back, and it's on the back lower right where it says departure sentences. And if you look under aggravating factors, I would draw your attention to number B, which says vulnerable victim, and number F, which says violation of public trust or professional responsibility. It's hard for me to imagine a prosecutor in a case like this not making use of these aggravating factors. It's hard for me in my 17 years of criminal law practice to imagine a judge not finding that those factors fit and that the person in this situation would in fact receive an enhanced sentence because of the exact same reasons that this bill is before you, because the offender did pick a vulnerable victim based on the relationship and because the offender did violate an expectation of public trust or professional responsibility. OCDLA does not oppose people in that situation receiving a harsher punishment than other offenders for that crime. We simply think there is not the need for a new crime to be established, but for the bill to be enacted. The only other thing I wanted to add is that ACLU is not able to be present today, but I know they join in our concerns. Thank you very much, unless there's any questions.
Are there any? Representative Stigler.
Yes, sir. I just want to be real clear that I understand the aggravating factors aspect of the sentencing guidelines, but application of those are subject to the court's discretion, correct?
That is
right.
True.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Yeah, I guess I'd just flip your argument and say if we're going to do it anyway, what do we lose by sending the signal to the public that we really mean it and having it not just at the discretion or choice of prosecutors and judges, but making it pretty clear. If it's already really clear it's aggravated, let's memorialize it. So I guess I'd accept your feedback and flip the argument.
I mean, I guess what I would say is more general and less specific, and I guess what I would say is that when the guidelines were put together, they were put together as a cohesive system, and the aggravating factors were put in there to address situations like this where there is an extra reason to impose a harsher punishment than normal. And the authors of the guidelines took that approach rather than not having aggravating factors and trying to micromanage every specific possible fact situation. So other than that, I really don't have anything else to say to that, Representative Smith.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair Parker.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2476. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2478.
House Bill 2478 modifies the crime of sex abuse in the second degree to include intentionally propelling a dangerous substance at another person. Again, in this bill, we do not yet have a fiscal impact statement.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bruin. If you'd go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. I'm Scott Bruin, representing House District 37, and up here with me today is Dave O'Shaughnessy. Dave is a captain with the Sheriff's Office in Clackamas County, so Thank you for being here today, Dave. I appreciate it. House Bill 2478 comes about from an incident that happened in Clackamas County in March of last year, and I've struggled with how I'm going to describe the incident, and I've realized that I can't do it in a way that protects really anybody's innocence, so I just have to sort of say what happened. It was at a Target store in Clackamas, and there was a young mother that had a 3-4-year-old child with her that was shopping at Target and discovered all of a sudden that she had a wet substance on her, and when she turned around and was trying to figure out what had happened, a man was running away from her. She discovered what the substance was. It was semen, as you can imagine. It was a horrific situation for her. Long story short, they had the they had video surveillance at the Target. They ended up releasing that as part of a press release. The guy turned him in. They caught the guy. The issue that comes from that led to House Bill 2478 is how that event was treated in criminal statute. Basically, it was treated not as any sort of a sex crime, or not as any sort of as potentially a dangerous substance in this modern day of disease we live in, but was instead treated as a harassment. And that's the only thing that statute would guide the prosecutors toward here was harassment. Not to demean or belittle harassment charges. There was both a Class A and a Class B harassment charge, and those are significant charges. But it didn't rise, at least in my opinion. And I think in many, especially some of the law enforcement officials that were involved with it, didn't rise to the level of truly what the crime was. As you can imagine, this an event like that could have a horrific impact on a person. Certainly, have a horrific impact on a child. The child was the child actually. As I understand it, the woman had her back to this person at the Target store. The child did not. The child saw the event that preceded the propelling of the man's semen onto the woman. And as she described to the police, the child thought that the man was urinating on the floor. Of course, that's not what happened, but that's what the child saw and put two and two together and saw. So basically, the current statute treats something like that the equivalent of me in a very harassing and assaulting way throwing a box of popcorn on somebody, or you name the infraction, and we feel that a bodily fluid like this rises to a different level. It's not the same thing as popcorn or water or something like that. It's a different deal. It's obviously or potentially could be a dangerous substance, and in any regard, it's certainly not in the interest nor the desire of the person this happens to. So what House Bill 2478 does is specifically defines this act and raises it to a sexual abuse in the second degree. In that case, the person would have to be all the sexual crime registration that the current statute has now, and we think that's appropriate. So thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Before Dave goes, I just want to say that this bill has been a long time in the making, and I want to make sure that I give credit. The originator of the concept for this bill is former Representative Linda Flores, who spent a lot of time and effort on it, and her then assistant at the time, Don Phillips, has done a lot of legwork. I just want to make sure that they're publicly recognized for the hard work that they did on getting the bill to where it is today. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak as well. I don't know that I can be... can offer much more in terms of very concise piece, but I'll give it a go. Here's a 31-year-old mother shopping at Target with her 4-year-old daughter and looking at razors on the razor aisle. A man unknown to her still doesn't. Well, she knows through the case, but there's no relationship between the suspect and this woman at all, other than he saw her in the Target store and thought she was attractive. Walks between her 4-year-old daughter and her, and she feels something on the back of her pant leg, thought her daughter had spilled something on her, so she naturally reaches down with her hand and realizes that it wasn't her daughter. Guy just walks out of the store. And the frustrating thing for law enforcement and for the detectives in this case, they even went after interviewing him. He says, my whole life I've had these strange sexual urges, and admits to what had gone on, and they look at how do we charge this person with something other than walking down a hallway and shoving somebody, offensive physical contact. And ultimately, that was the only charge that fit. The district attorney's office, to their credit, did try to charge with a sex abuse crime, and the jury didn't agree with the argument that they made. There were two counts of third-degree sex abuse. There's clearly a sexual nature in this event. And so to have to resort to, you know, a slap, a shove, or the box of popcorn thrown at somebody is the only recourse for what really, I can't think of a much more offensive offensive contact. But since there was not direct body contact with direct body, it didn't fit the existing statute. So we certainly applaud the efforts of Representative Flores and Representative Bruin in trying to address this where it needs to fit and give us some tools that, unfortunately, this creeps up more than I ever thought I would encounter when I first got into the business 20 years ago.
And so, Kevin, could you say your name for the record? These are recorded and they need to know.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's Dave O'Shaughnessy.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that we clearly state that this is not an isolated, we wish that it were, but it's not an isolated incident. There's an event that took place, just that I have the news clipping on, there was an event that took place of May of last year in Dallas, Oregon. Different situation. It wasn't in a public venue. It was at a private home, but it was a man who was, they were intoxicated. Apparently they'd been out drinking, and they were at, a man was at his friend's home. The friend was married. Middle of the night, the wife wakes up and discovers that similar incident had happened and presses charges. And again, the only charge that would stick was harassment and lewd conduct, but certainly not a sexual crime. Also found out today that, and thankfully not in Oregon, at least not in Oregon that I've ever heard about, and hopefully never in Oregon, but apparently there are some gangs, as part of their initiation rite, that a gang member is required to produce semen and take it to a mall and flick it on somebody, for lack of a better way to describe it, as part of an initiation rite. I can't tell you what specific gang that is or where that happened, but just obviously a horrific act and something we hope never happens close to home. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Definition, my computer just went off, the definition of dangerous substance obviously includes the case you're talking about. What other fluids, and I mean, it's graphic, and I apologize to everybody listening.
Yeah, thanks for getting me on tape for this.
Yeah, sorry. I apologize.
No, on line 13 of the written bill, dangerous substance includes blood, urine, semen, or feces.
Thanks, and not saliva?
No. Excuse me?
The saliva is not on the list?
No.
Saliva is not on the
list. Thanks very much. That's my question.
Thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Greg Hazarabedian on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA does not impose what we believe is the intent of this bill. We believe the intent of this bill is to raise to a felony level the flinging of these dangerous substances on somebody for a sexual purpose. And that, I believe, is the part that we find missing from this bill. If you're going to make a lifetime registrable sex offense, we believe that there should be language in the bill that includes that something was done for a sexual purpose in the with a sexual intent. In the sexual contact definition that is used in the statute in 163.305 sub 6, which is the definition that's used for the sexual touching and sex abuse and those kind of crimes, requires that it's done for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of either party. OCDLA would support this bill if there was some requirement that the conduct here sought to be increased in punishment had that language included in it. The bill as written includes lots of conduct potentially that is not sexual in nature, and we strongly oppose people ending up with a lifetime sexual offender registration for a non-sexual crime.
I know this will make some folks around here fall over in their chairs, but I happen to agree with what you're saying, that I think there needs to be a connection with, I mean, I think there needs to be somehow an inference, there needs to be the ability to connect it to
a sexual
act, that there's sexual gratification or a sexual intent, however we can put that in there so that it, I mean, the incidents that have been described, that's exactly, I mean, somebody ejaculating in a store isn't doing it for the heck of it. They're doing it for sexual gratification, pardon my English, but I would agree that we, if we can maybe, if we're gonna, since we're not working this today, maybe we can come up with some language that'll bring it into the loop.
Or if we made it an assault three, which didn't have that factor in, would that be?
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Stiegler, I'm under the impression that there's another piece of legislation working its way through this building that would expand the crime of assault to include some of this behavior, too. I believe there's a work group that is going to be or has been or will be formed on that piece of legislation. And so OCDLA would either say that this should be an assaultive crime and dealt with through that other piece of legislation, or if the intent, clearly the intent of the people who introduced this seems to be to create a new type of sexual offense, and like I say, OCDLA does not oppose that. We just want to see a nexus to a sexual purpose before we create another sexual offense. And like I said, the language that's already been used, quote, for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of the party, is used in other Oregon statutes around this area, seems sufficient here.
Thank you.
Oh. My question actually is that the other bill that he's speaking of only covers, I believe, police officers. So my question to you is, would OCDLA oppose a bill that encompassed the general population and basically elevated the flinging of any of these dangerous substances on the general population as an assault three?
As OCDLA president, I'm not comfortable answering that without talking to the legislative committee about it. Our lobbyist, Gail Meyer, would need to be involved in that discussion. Certainly, if there's a work group on the other bill, we would very much like to be at the table and address that. So I'm simply unable to tell you right now what our position would be on that. I'm sorry, counsel.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, and as we get together, which is either, I guess, early next week, the happy to discuss whatever you'd have us discuss. I would just say for the record, I don't want to be lost in any of that conversation, the very particular and important circumstances that I think we're wanting to cover, that it is, I think it's very different if somebody flings crap on somebody, okay, or I could imagine because they're mean, and the case that Representative Bruin is bringing, which I think raises our ire collectively in a very powerful way, and I think that if something's a sex crime, it is not illegitimate for us to call it a sex crime. So just to say that.
I think you hit the point very well about adding language. If it is going to be a sex crime, it has to be a sex crime, not something else. So, Representative Stiegler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd just echo that concern exactly. I don't want this situation getting lost in the shuffle of trying to come to something on a broader, because I think it's more focused and deviant behavior.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair Parker.
Yes. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2478. Open a hearing on House Bill 2441.
House Bill 2441 modifies current law which requires corroboration before a confession is admissible and creates an exception for sex crimes against vulnerable victims when the confession is deemed trustworthy and the victim is incompetent to testify. You also have three sets of amendments on this in front of you, -1, -2s, and -3s. On this, we do not have a fiscal impact statement.
Just to go, so. Representative Gelser, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, and I am the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. House Bill 2441 is a bill that I have been working on for a very long time. It is part of a package of bills that is intended to address the abuse of vulnerable adults in the state of Oregon. Its primary companion bill, House Bill 2442, is sitting right now in the Human Services Committee. Originally, this bill was going to be part of it, but I thought it was important that the Judiciary Committee have the opportunity to wrestle with the issue of confessions rather than leaving that to the Human Services Committee. What's important to recognize, and my interest in this came from the perspective of the developmental disability community, and the recognition that people with developmental disabilities are at a heightened risk of sexual abuse from any other population in our communities. We have had two national studies which indicate that among women with developmental disabilities, 80% of them will become victims of rape or sexual assault in their lifetimes. 80%, 80. Of that 80% of women, 50% of them will be abused 10 times or more. These cases are rarely prosecuted for a whole variety of reasons, one of them being that these individuals, because of their vulnerability and their cognitive disability, are very often unable to be good witnesses in court and to talk about what it is that's happened to them. Also, because the individuals who victimize these very vulnerable people are often their caregivers, it's very unlikely that it will be reported in a timely fashion or that the individuals will get the medical attention they need and a rape kit collected. It's very unlikely that a caregiver will rape someone and then take them to the hospital for a rape kit before taking them to the bathroom, changing their catheter, or fixing their dinner, or getting them dressed for bed. That is the vulnerability of the individuals that we are talking about. As we began our discussions about abuse of people with developmental disabilities last February, after we had learned that within state-paid group and foster care homes, one in five adults with a developmental disability had been abused significantly within a seven-year period from 2000 to 2007. So as we were discussing these things, an issue began brewing in my own district that was related, and that's where this bill comes from. The first case was a guy who worked at a memory care facility, and he had sexually assaulted a couple of his coworkers. And while he was in the interview for those assaults that had been reported by the coworkers, I believe, he confessed to sexually assaulting three elderly women with Alzheimer's. This case eventually went to court. It was prosecuted. He was convicted, and he was sentenced to 99 years without the possibility of parole. Upon appeal, the convictions for the crimes committed against his co-workers were upheld, but the convictions for the crimes committed against the three elderly women with Alzheimer's were dismissed because, except for that confession, there wasn't other evidence that those crimes had occurred. If you can imagine these individuals with Alzheimer's, they were not able to go to court and testify in that way. And as with many sex crimes, it's very often very difficult to have other physical evidence, which is why you have that he said, she said in a court case. After that, there was another case that referenced this, Oregon Supreme Court, and this was the Delp case, and I believe that was here in Marion County. In this case, there was an individual, he was the subject of some sort of a sting on child pornography. And in the midst of that interview, for his possession of child pornography, he disclosed that he had been sexually abusing the toddler child of his girlfriend while he was enjoying this internet porn. He was prosecuted, he too was convicted, and in this case as well, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction on the sexual abuse of the child for the same reason. And in this case, the Supreme Court in their ruling said this was an issue for the legislature to address because this corpus delicti rule really creates an issue for very vulnerable victims of sex crimes for these reasons. This has been an exercise for me in learning. My initial response to these things were that we should be like the state of North Dakota, which got rid of the corpus delicti rule altogether. And so I called together this work group to work on these broader issues around abuse of vulnerable adults. And my intention at the beginning of that group was to bring to you a bill that said, let's get rid of this rule altogether. We had great discussions in this work group. Bronson James was a member of this work group from the appellate division, I believe, and who had been involved in these other two cases. We we had prosecutors, we had lively discussions among people who had been involved in arguing both sides of each of these cases. And through that discussion, I became convinced that there's a very good reason that we have this rule, and that is we can't convict people based on false confessions. And I also came to understand that the very people that we are trying to protect are the people that are most at risk of giving false confessions, people with mental retardation, people with a mental illness, juveniles. And so what I've brought to you is a bill that is very, very narrow. Many states do have exceptions to the corpus delicti rule. This would be one of the narrowest in the entire country. And basically what it says is that only in the case of a sex crime where the victim is a vulnerable person that the court has determined is incompetent to testify at trial, and only when in a pretrial hearing the judge has determined that the confession is trustworthy, and only when that defendant himself or herself is not themselves a person with a mental disability, a mental illness, or a juvenile. In these cases, the confession may be admitted, and if the jury convicts, they can convict based on that confession alone. So very, very narrow exception that would have addressed the issues in both of the two cases that I just identified for you. There are amendments to the bill. I would say there is universal agreement that the bill as written does not work. So the bill needs to be amended. I am most supportive of the -1 amendment, which clarifies that confessions, of course, can be admitted. It's the issue of whether or not you can convict based on a confession alone. You also have before you the -3 amendments, which are similar to the -1s, except for that it would add an additional restriction that would require that the confession be recorded in order for it to be accepted. And for full disclosure, in both the Delp case and the Simons case, we have checked, and both of those confessions were recorded. I have concerns about this. While I am generally supportive to the idea of taping confessions generally, I am worried that if you put that on this particular bill, that it will make it very difficult to use it. If you go into a situation of interviewing someone and you know they are likely to confess, and therefore you know to turn on the electronic recording device, you likely have some other evidence to support the crime, in which case you would not need this exception to this rule anyway, because you would have that other evidence. That said, I would rather have this bill with that difficulty in it than have no bill at all. But my preference is definitely the -1. I think this will help some very vulnerable people who need it, and it will protect people who have not yet been hurt by putting some of these people away and keeping them away from their future victims. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a very clear explanation of the issues. Very good. Any questions? Representative? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. And I just want to thank all of the people that have worked on this. It was an unusual combination of people, and everyone has been very candid and open and helpful, and I'm very appreciative of that.
Ms. Meyer, why don't you go ahead and come on? You guys come on up. I know you're on a time restriction, so we'll go ahead and put you in the...
Chair Barker, Greg Hezer, president of OCDLA, one more time. I'm here on this bill just briefly to say that Representative Gelser included OCDLA participation at the very front end of this process, which has gone on much of a year, as she talked about. We're very appreciative of that. We were included at the front end. We've been included throughout the discussions on this bill, and we just wanted to publicly express our appreciation to Representative Gelser for that process. I'm going to let Ms. Meyer speak to the substance of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are in support of the -3 amendment. I would like to echo Greg Hezrabedian's statement that we feel Representative Gelser really did genuinely, she was very sensitive to the importance of the corpus delicti rule as it relates to our construct of how we resolve adjudications as to crimes. And for the, I don't know if everyone on the committee really knows what the corpus delicti rule is, and so just only very briefly, it means, it's Latin, it means the body of the crime. And it came to us really from feudal England, and it goes to the heart of keeping the burden of proof on the government when they make an allegation. You must have proof of the crime being committed in order to convict the defendant, not simply the defendant's statements. And apparently it came from feudal England, where someone confessed to a murder, and then they executed the person who made the confession, and then 2 years later the ostensible decedent walked back into the village, and so they realized they had executed someone who had made a false confession. So that's come with us throughout throughout our history, and it's been recognized in the 50 states. It has been diluted substantially in some states, but so far not ours. So OCDLA doesn't take lightly to diluting the corpus delicti rule, but we do feel that this is a very, as to the Dash 3 amendments, a very balanced approach to that. The reason we feel that it's important to record the defendant's statements is just simply this. And the recordation piece of it is on line 2 of page 2 of the Dash 3. That's the only difference between the Dash 3 and the Dash 1 is simply that line that the confession must be electronically recorded. And our reasons for feeling that it's really important to include that is just this, that if you are going to make the sum total of evidence against the defendant's statement, then let's make sure that we accurately have a recordation of the defendant's statement. I mean, if that's all the evidence that it's going to be, let's make sure it's total, it's complete, and it's accurate. This does come into play in a real critical way if there's a translator involved, an interpreter. It has been known that interpreter translators don't always grasp the dialectical meaning or differences of the declarant, meaning the defendant here. And so when you do have an interpreter or translator, it's really essential that the recording machine be on. There is a population of people, it's a small subset, but they do exist, who are very vulnerable to making false statements. We saw that with the individual who gathered a lot of attention to himself when he made a confession publicly to having killed Renee, the little girl, what's her name?
John Vonnegut Ramsey.
Thank you. And it was a false statement. And so there is a small sliver of people who are prone to making false statements. And so if we are going to be convicting people solely on their words alone, OCDLA feels it is essential to make sure that we have an accurate recording of the defendant's words. With respect to costs, if that might be a concern to anyone, OCDLA has a bill that's now being entertained on the House side that would require recordation of interrogations as it relates to person felonies. So we've done some homework. We do know most law enforcement agencies have some recording. We're not talking about video wired into the ceiling at all. We're talking about, you know, a $75 digital recorder that can be put on the table. And most agencies have way more than one. I think that's it. If there's any
Thank
questions.
Any questions? Yeah. Okay, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just responding to Representative Gelser's comment that this would blow it up entirely, would make it almost useless. Is that, talk me through that, and if it requires you repeating something, that's great. But I heard her say, hey, if we do the Dash 3 amendments, it almost defeats the purpose of the bill. And I don't know if that's true or not. I want to understand if it's true or not.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, what I understood Representative Gelson to be saying is that for there to be an interrogation of a defendant such that the police would think of recording that statement, it must mean that there was some reason to suspect that individual, and so therefore that must mean that there was some prior other evidence that would incriminate or convict that individual. I believe I understand Representative Gelser correctly in her statement there. And
And we could imagine a circumstance where somebody said, I did it, and we said, well, I could either get that on tape, and then we said, and then they said, yeah, I really did do it, and now we've got it on tape and go, and the concern might be, well, they might not say it again.
Correct. I would agree. And so, Chair Barker and Representative Smith, I think that what a middle ground between what you're saying and what our primary concerns are is that perhaps it should be amended to say, a confession or statement made during interrogation by law enforcement or something to that effect. But so that if there is that statement made to an individual on a work site, never to be repeated later, that might be a difference.
Thanks. And let me just say, I also, you know, to the extent it sounds like it's true, to the extent we could be getting bills where multiple smart people with different perspectives can be weighing in on how we get the best bill, before they come to us, I can speak only for myself, but it's very helpful.
I think some of the concern is the confession that isn't recorded and then somebody has a change of heart, and those, of course, could be challenged, but we certainly appreciate your perspective. There is another bill, as you said, coming through that would require recordation, and should this bill pass without that, and that bill passes, that would, then we'd be making some changes here. So thank you very much for your perspective on that. It's very helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
So, okay, R3. Since Stellar, I believe, Stellar, and Jody Beretta, and Doug Harkleroad. Thank you. And please go ahead in any order. Just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sid Stellar, and I live with my wife in King City. We're members of the VOR, which is an advocacy organization, kind of smaller brother to the ARC. We've both served on different boards of caregiving organizations that deal with developmentally disabled people and provide care and services to them. The parents and guardians of our adult daughter who suffers a mental impairment in the severe range. Now, for those of you that may not know, there are the impairments in the mild and moderate, severe, and profound range. So you're kind of downscale when you're in the severe range. When she was 10 years old, we were able to find a private licensed nonprofit home for her, where she lived for some time. It was volunteer stuff, and we did pay a monthly fee, and we worked on the work parties to help improve the facility. We contributed funds for extra projects, and we built kind of a life around that place. Well, in 1985, at the age of 24, we were informed that she had been sexually molested by a male employee who was subsequently fired. No further relief was coming from the district attorney of that county because she was considered an unreliable witness. She transferred to another residence, but the facility could not cope with her anger. At the time, we did not understand her anger either, but now we do. She came home again, and we had her entered into a private psychiatric hospital to get her calmed down. And then she was at home for a while, and then she entered Fairview Training Center, where she seemed to improve. The Fairview administration gave us, in writing, a guarantee of female-only care as we began to observe that more and more males were dealing with female residents of that facility. I'm not an attorney, and I don't know all the legal ins and outs of this bill. I haven't seen the amendments you've been talking about, but I'm sure it will need some amendments. Had such a bill been in effect at the time that our daughter was abused, we we might have had a different outcome. Her abuser went on to work in another agency here in Oregon, serving mentally impaired residents. We members of VOR have had meetings with Sheriff Dan Noel, the former sheriff of Multnomah County, with the Nunnan Camps, who are both deputy sheriffs of Washington County and experts in sexual abuse and that sort of thing, and used to travel around to different sheriff's departments giving information and education on the subject. And Ava Kutas, who is the director of the Office of Investigations and Training for the Department of Human Services. All of them have impressed on us the difficulty of prosecuting sexual offenders who prey upon vulnerable people. As I examine the bill, I see the possibility of more narrowly defining vulnerable persons, because not everyone over 65, for example, is incapacitated. But I'm confident that this committee can work out a bill that will be helpful. Our daughter cannot be here to speak for herself, and there are many others who we have met who are in the same circumstances. Some of them are too angry and bitter to come here and give you testimony today. They don't feel they have been served justly. We are here to speak for them too, and we thank you for hearing us out.
Thank you very much for that very tough testimony. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, my name is Jody Beretta, and I'm a Marion County Deputy District Attorney. I'm also here today representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of Amendment-1 to this bill. It's an important distinction because the bill as written would actually make our job as prosecutors much more difficult, and it's completely unacceptable. So we are here only in support of Amendment-1. Prosecutors need this statutory fix. We need something to enable us to truly stand up for the rights and advocate for the punishment of offenders who prey upon the most vulnerable victims that we have. Talking not only about people with developmental disabilities, but also pre-verbal children, nonverbal children. This would also incorporate victims who, because of fear or threat, are just unable to testify. They would be deemed incompetent. You already heard from Representative Gelsner about one of the Marion County cases, which is State v. Delp, which brought this bill to the table. Unfortunately, there are many examples like that. I've got a couple more from Marion County, one of which was a case that, because of the blanket cooperation required currently in the statute, we were unable to prosecute. That was a case where a man had been convicted of horrendous sexual abuse of three of his children, three older children. During one of his therapy sessions, he confessed that at the time he was currently sexually abusing his 16-month-old daughter. We could not prosecute that case, even though we knew that this man had a predisposition towards children. There wasn't any cooperation, because in sex abuse cases where you're talking about a pre-verbal victim and you're discussing abuse that just involves touching, there is no physical evidence, there is no eyewitness, and there is no videotape. There was another case that just got reversed on appeal, much like the Delp case, where it was a juvenile offender who was treated as an adult because he was already a convicted, adjudicated minor. He sexually abused a young girl, an 18-month-old, in a bathtub. He gave a full confession. He talked about liking child pornography. He even had a witness who knew he was alone in the room and had the opportunity to abuse the child. That boy was convicted in a bench trial. The Court of Appeals overturned that conviction because there was not sufficient corroboration to the abuse. Prosecutors need this tool in order to ensure that somebody stands up for those victims who can't speak for themselves. As for the difference in Amendment-1 compared to Amendment-3, as you've already heard, the difference is the recording. The one thing I'd like to say is, of course, we're completely in agreement with Representative Gelsner in that matter. And I think that an important thing for this committee to know is in the Delp case that you've heard so much about, the conviction that was overturned here in Marion County, that initial confession was not recorded. That initial confession took place at the house when a search warrant was being served, and that is, I can tell you in my experience, what normally happens in these cases. Police officers, for very good tactical interviewing techniques, they don't pull out the tape recorder. They get a confession first and then say, can we go on to record? Many of those people then say, no, you can't. So that's just one example of why requiring a recording would not serve this bill's true purpose. I would ask that you please help prosecutors and these vulnerable victims and give us the tools that we need. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Harkelrode, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkelrode. I'm a retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance supports the Dash 1 Amendment to this bill. A quick little story. There was a mom who hired a babysitter. His name was Robin, a male. He was 19 years old. At the end of the day, mom came home, and Robin, the babysitter, was paid and left. Mom sat down in the overstuffed chair, as she did frequently with the three-year-old child, who had some verbal skills, but not much. And the child said to mom, Robin swings me around in the air and licks my TT. TT, for that child, was vagina. Mom did the right thing and called the police. Officer responded. It was a patrol officer who found the facts from mom, obviously couldn't interview the three-year-old child, and went and contacted Robin. Advised him of his rights, asked him to come to the police department, and Robin confessed in great detail. The officer did everything right. I think he actually gave the advice twice. I tried that case before 1985, and Judge Allen searched and searched to figure out a way, because there was no real corroboration. But there was a wonderful confession that Judge Allen said is a wonderful confession. The officer did everything right. And he found the defendant guilty using some hearsay from mom that I called the mom to testify about. And that case was reversed. Now, there's a whole bunch of those cases that Ms. Beretta has told you about, and that's been a long-standing problem. This fixes that problem. Good confessions that are trustworthy, that are done right, with the judge reviewing those and making sure they're done right and they're trustworthy, fixes this problem, and these people can be convicted. So that's why we support the Dash 1 amendments. We don't support the Dash 3 amendments because, as counsel Ms. Beretta correctly stated, officers do interviews, get confessions, and then ask if they'll do it on tape, and the answer is no. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Bronson James, Christine Harmon, and Bob Junde. And please go ahead and, in the order, just identify yourself for the record as we are recording this.
Thank you, Chairman Barker, representatives of the committee. My name is Bronson James. I am Chief Deputy Defender for Oregon's Office of Public Defense Services. I worked rather extensively with Representative Gelser in her work group and committee over the last year that resulted in this bill. I also wanted to begin my comments by taking a moment to note the great care that Representative Gelser has shown throughout this process in identifying a perceived problem and being very cognizant of any sort of legal ripples that would come from that change, and doing essentially taking a problem and applying a scalpel to it rather than a hatchet. And I think that she should be commended for that. And I can tell you that my opportunity to work with her in this has been a fantastically rewarding experience. And I believe that the bill that you have in front of you is a very good piece of legislation. I can tell you that the position of the Office of Public Defense Services is that with respect to either dash 1, dash 2, or dash 3, we would be neutral. The bill as it came out of the Legislative Council's office initially, I think, is just sort of a bit of an aberration and not quite reflecting Representative Gelser's original intent. Like everybody else, we would oppose that bill, but on the others, we would be neutral. And as may have become apparent or not, I am the attorney that handled both State versus Simons and State versus Delp. I got those convictions overturned. I know a few things about the law of corpus delicti and confession and where that rule comes from. If this committee has any questions about how that rule functions, how it functions both in this state, other states, and in it exists in many common law countries, I'd be happy to answer them for you. I would also take time to call out to the committee's attention certain portions, and I'll use dash one as an example here, what I consider to be very important provisions of this bill, and one of the reasons that this, you know, the dash ones work. First, as has been noted, this is sort of a very limited carve-out. It's limited both by the nature of the crime and the nature of the victim. The other thing that I think is really a critical component here of this bill is when you go down and you start talking about what the trial court would consider in evaluating the general trustworthiness of the bill, you will note in Section 2, the statute is worded as the court shall consider. So the statute mandates certain items of consideration in evaluating the trustworthiness. And one of the really interesting things about this bill and why it is, as Representative Gelser said, is sort of a limited chip away from corpus delicti as compared to other states, is it requires the trial court to consider both the methods of interrogation used to elicit that confession and the defendant's status, as whether the defendant may be a vulnerable person. And I can tell you from my experience, both as a trial attorney as an appellate attorney, it has been my experience that more often than not, crimes against vulnerable populations occur from within those vulnerable populations. It is frequently people with mental illness that abuse people with mental illness. It is crimes by one group home member against another group home member. But this legislation, both requiring consideration not only of the type of interrogation methods used, but how those interrogation methods would function against this particular defendant, is what I consider to be an excellent part of this bill. And if the committee has any questions, I would be happy to entertain them.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. The Sexual Assault Task Force is in support of the Dash 1 amendments on this bill. Feel that it is an important consideration for those victims who are unable to speak for themselves. There are several instances that would fall under the purview of this bill. You've heard about some of them from prior testimony. We've heard about the three-year-old child who discloses sexual abuse, the offender who admits that what she says is true, who's not held accountable because, like in most sexual abuse cases, there is no physical evidence, there is no corroborating evidence, and a three-year-old child almost never will be found competent to testify. A father confesses to digitally penetrating his infant child. That father may have reasons to confess. There will be no way to hold him accountable because there will be no way for an infant child to corroborate what was happening, and certainly there will be no physical evidence. A mentally retarded adult woman who reports sexual assault is found incompetent to testify, and the offender laughs about how he chose her because he knew that no one would believe her. Like we know, sex offenders choose their victims based in part on their vulnerability. The current state of the law makes those victims were already vulnerable, even more so. The change that would be enacted with the -1 amendments to House Bill 2441 would help to mitigate some of that vulnerability and bring the victim some degree of availability to justice. I would like to just note briefly that we do not support the -3 amendments, the recording requirement. It was earlier mentioned that there are people that do falsely confess to crimes, an example being the person who confessed to the JonBenet Ramsey murder. I think that's probably the one we all here know the most. It's important to remember that person was never charged. That was very clearly a false confession. It was determined to be a false confession during the investigation. There was never any concern that that man was going to be convicted. We're not talking about those types of confessions. We're talking about confessions that are trustworthy based on their circumstances and the circumstances of the crime itself. So I encourage you to help those victims who can't stand up for themselves by passing these 2441 with the -1 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Jundep, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundep. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon, and we're an organization that's funded by the federal government to protect and advocate the rights of people with disabilities. Sexual assault among people with disabilities is a very significant problem, both in our state and nationally, and I provided you with some statistics that demonstrate the extent of that problem. And we'd like to thank Representative Gelzer for the work that she's done in putting this bill together, which we feel is an appropriate step to take in order to add greater protections for people with disabilities who may be victimized. Our one concern when we were working with Representative Gelzer had to do with situations that were just earlier noted when a person with disabilities comes under suspicion of being the perpetrator, particularly people with mental retardation are vulnerable to false confessions. And this is actually a phenomenon that was noted by the Supreme Court in the case of Atkins versus Virginia that ruled that capital punishment is not appropriate for people with developmental disabilities, mental retardation. Senator Gelzer, much to her credit, worked to craft adequate protections for those situations, and we feel that that they are taken into account and specifically noted in HB 2441. And so we are here to add our voice in support of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions at all? Thank you very much. Is there any discussion among the committee? What I would like to do, we can't move the bill completely because we don't have the fiscal. We've had the discussion, and it's my belief, and based on my experience of a few decades, that whenever possible, the police will record confessions, but sometimes it happens, as was stated, somebody will confess and then say, I don't want to talk on the tape. This bill has provisions to make sure that the judge will make sure that the confession is good. I think there's adequate protections there, and the things that were discussed, the police are reluctant. Prosecution is reluctant to have the recordation requirement because they don't want to lose the case because somebody says, no, I don't want to record it now. And especially in dealing with vulnerable people, and if the perpetrator is one of those people, the police are aware of that as well, and they know that they have to be very, very careful in those confessions. I was involved in a case that had to do with more of a juvenile. She wasn't, I don't think, mentally disabled, but it's a lot different than if you're dealing with adults. And police are aware of that. And if they're not aware of that, the courts will straighten that out when it comes before them. There's safeguards on that. It would be my intent to move this bill, to adopt the -1 amendments to this bill, and then we'll hold it off. Also, as was mentioned earlier, in the building there's another bill that would require recordation in person crimes. Should that bill pass, then this would be adjusted, and that would be covered in that. So it wouldn't be like we're carving this out if that other bill takes place. So it would be, I believe, the best thing for us to do today would be to move the -1 and then we'll close the hearing. Is there any discussion about that? Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, and I know I did this once before, and I would appreciate, frankly, just because of the nature of the testimony, it truly kind of it impacted me a great deal. And I would appreciate some time to kind of calm down a bit and think it through, if that is possible, for one day, for example.
Okay. I would like to move this day. We're going to start getting really backed up in this committee, as I was meeting this morning, and we're getting another stack of bills, and Monday we're going to have a huge stack coming. So I'm afraid if we delay too much, all of a sudden it'll be June 30th, and we're going to be out of here. Yeah, Representative Stegler.
Well, the only thing I would say in regard to that, I think there's some concert of agreement here that the bill is drafted is not what we want. So I think if we move either, adopt either the one or the three amendments, -1 or -3, I think then that's what we get put on for consideration. And obviously, since there's no fiscal yet, we're not going to hold a work session on it.
Well, we'll hold a work session
just to adopt the amendments, but we won't go beyond that. We won't do a
There will also be time that has to go to the other side of the building, and where you would be able to, should, after you could reconsider it, you'd be able to go testify there if we need to change it.
Mr. Chair, I agree. The only issue I had worked out in my mind was the recording question, but I agree with you that I think it makes sense to take that up in a more comprehensive way with the other bill rather than in the context of this bill. So I would support the -1s.
Okay, thank you. I'll accept a motion to adopt the -1.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. We'll close the public hearing and open the work session.
What?
Oh, okay. We can go ahead and discuss it even with the work session.
Okay, great. Tell me when.
Go ahead.
Thanks. As is frequent, I wonder, and don't disagree with Representative Garrett that it may be when we're
Mr. Chair,
throat.
Mr. Chair, just a point of order. Are we in a public hearing or are we in a work session right now?
We're in a work session.
Thank you. When we are with sort of full throat and full attention addressing the issue of recordation, we might, and because we have now a chance to at least start thinking about that, and as I sort of bring up frequently, there might be sort of a middle path, right? And I even wonder, and maybe we don't need to address it here, we can address it just in the other, if there is a way to get at both the encourage recordation and discourage the case which is on all our minds, where we say I did it and they say okay, click the tape, and no, I didn't do it, right? And upon refusal, then allowing admission of the recordation. And so I just wanted to get that out there as we start thinking about this, in part because I know there are smart people listening who are jockeying around this stuff, and to signal them, and I'm cool whether it's the -1, however we want to get this bill out. I'm cool.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that we adopt the -1 amendments to 2441.
President Cameron moves the -1 amendments be adopted. Is there any discussion? Roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Public, or the work session is closed on House Bill 2441. -1s are adopted. Thank you.
And can we again thank Representative Gelzer for
her
yeoman's job in this?
And everybody else who was on the work
absolutely
work groups that came up with the amendments to make this work and hopefully safeguard not only the victims but the accused as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
When the other bill does come, if we do pass the recording, I think we need to carve out a piece to address these vulnerable people about the recording portion. Otherwise, we've undone everything that she's tried to work to do for a year.
Good point. Thank you. You open a public hearing on House Bill 2447.
House Bill 2447 creates a crime of felony strangulation. There are -1 amendments. And we do not have a fiscal on this yet. We have Representative Gelder.
Okay. Representative Gelser and Ms. Skinner, please.
Let him hear.
Mr. Chair, colleagues, I bill, Representative Sarah Gelser, thanks for having me back today, and for a second time today, you are fortunately almost done with my bills. The bill that's before you today, House Bill 2447, is a bill that many of you heard from me about last session, and you passed out of this committee unanimously through Ways and Means. This would elevate the crime of strangulation to a felony in certain circumstances. What I told you last time was, as I talked to constituents about working on this bill, they give me a puzzled look saying, what? Strangulation isn't a felony? And in fact, it was not even a misdemeanor until very recent history. The reason why it's important to elevate this crime to a felony in certain circumstances is that when a domestic violence situation has increased to the point where strangulation occurs, that is the number one predictor that that domestic violence situation is going to end in a homicide. Strangulation is also the primary method of control that is used in the commission of rape. Women in particular are at great risk through strangulation, and it is difficult to get away from these situations because right now the impact is there can be a slap on the wrist and the offender could be out walking the street again the next day, which has not provided this woman the opportunity to make arrangements to find a safe placement. We already know that she's at great risk. The elements in this bill, basically it's elevated to a felony if the individual has previously been convicted of these crimes, has previously been convicted of misdemeanor strangulation against the same victim, or if it's done with a dangerous or a deadly weapon. There's other people here that can talk about this much more smartly than I can, but it is a very important issue in terms of protecting the lives of women and the children that live with them in domestic violence situations, and I hope that you will again this year move this bill forward to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety.
My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I've been a deputy district attorney for over 11 years, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association in support of House Bill 2447. I can tell the committee that I have been involved in this issue of strangulation in front of this committee for many years. I was here testifying back in 2003 and was on with the group that wrote the original draft of the strangulation bill, and I've been here every session since trying to make it a felony. The original compromise back in 2003 was to make it a misdemeanor for fiscal purposes, and that the promise was always made that we would readdress the issue of making it a felony in the future, and we've continued every session to try to do that, and we're back in front of this session again trying to do the same thing. What we're passing out right now is what's called a danger assessment, and it is an assessment that is commonly used by law enforcement, probation officers, courts, other people that are dealing with chronic domestic violence offenders. And what is listed is 20 things that are the highest indicators of lethality for people that have committed domestic violence, and the more of these that you check, the more likely it is that they're going to kill their partner. And if you look at the list, most of these things are what the enhancements are in the bill. Questions about the frequency of domestic violence, the possession of weapons, if weapons have ever been used or threatened, and number 10, does he ever try to choke you? And that's a very common indicator, as Representative Gelser indicated, for the possibility or likelihood that potentially this relationship will end in a homicide. I want to refer to an article from the American Prosecutors Research Institute that was done regarding San Diego City Attorney's Office did a research study regarding our longitudinal study regarding strangulation. And it came out of the fact that they had two teen victims who were murdered. And as part of those cases, they went back and realized both of them had prior cases where the offender had been reported to have strangled them. And so because of that, they started looking at strangulation cases. And in looking at 300 misdemeanor domestic violence strangulation cases, they determined that children were present 41% of the time. And they determined that 89% had a prior domestic violence incidences. And so we know that this is not only are children present often, and that children learn domestic violence from watching it and then repeat it as adults. We also know that it is high on the lethality scale. As far as the actual action of strangulation, it only takes 11 pounds of pressure placed on both of your carotid arteries for 10 seconds to cause unconsciousness. And it is to close off someone's trachea, to close off the air passageway, there's only 33 pounds of pressure that is required. Somebody can be killed within 4 to 5 minutes as long as the strangulation persists. It is very deadly, and as Representative Gelser indicated, it is a number one action of showing control over another person, because you're basically telling them, I can kill you, and I may choose not to right now, but that doesn't mean that I won't do it in the future. As you can see from this bill, we still keep in place the original intent, which was that the fallback position, it is a misdemeanor, but if any of the issues arise that are indicated most commonly on this danger assessment, such as that the children were present, or that there was a weapon used, or if they have a prior conviction of strangulation, or if they have, as D indicates, prior convictions for, and it lists out assault 4, assault 3, assault 2, assault 1, or menacing, or equivalent crime in another jurisdiction with the same victim, then it would be a felony, or if there were 3 priors of the similar crimes, regardless of the victim, which mirrors a lot of language in the assault 4 statute, that would raise it to the level of felony. My law clerk did a little research and found 4 other states where there is strangulation legislation specifically, and in all those states it is a felony currently. That's in Indiana, North Carolina, Nebraska, and Minnesota. And she specifically noted that in Nebraska, it currently is a Class 4 felony if it's a plain strangulation, but it rises to a Class 3 felony if either a weapon was used, serious bodily injury occurred, or there was a prior conviction. So it sort of mirrors the language that we have here. I agree with Representative Gelser that the reaction I get when I train law enforcement at the police academy, which I've been doing for over 10 years on the issue of strangulation, the response I always get is, we can't believe that this is a misdemeanor. And then I tell them the story about why it's a misdemeanor. But the Oregon District Attorney Association recognizes how dangerous the situation is, and the compromise is, instead of making all cases a felony, to identify the ones that have the highest chance of lethality and trying to recognize that those people have even a chance of going to the Department of Corrections if they continue this type of behavior. And so we would strongly encourage this committee to pass House Bill 2447. We recognize that there will be a fiscal to this, but everything needs to be prioritized to some degree, and that the protection of vulnerable victims of domestic violence and their children, we believe, needs to be at the top of that priority list. Thank you.
Have you taken a look at the dash ones?
I have not.
Okay. I just would say we'll have a couple more people speak on this.
Chair, I have not seen the dash ones either.
Okay, thank you. Around 48 years ago in my training in the Marine Corps, one of the things they taught us was about the vulnerability of that area, the throat, and what to do to quickly kill somebody. And they kind of made a joke about it, that somebody was really tough. In those days, beer cans used to be steel. They're aluminum now, but they were a little harder to squeeze in those days. And they said somebody at the beach was squeezing him and showing off. And the other guy showed his girlfriend he could squeeze an ice cream cone and break it. And she said, well, what does that prove? And then he says, well, I could choke you with that, about that same level of strength that it takes to crush an ice cream cone. But so it is very dangerous. And I also had a personal request about to bring a bill forward this time, although Representative Gelser is bringing it forward, from the Yolanda House in Portland, which is a battered women's shelter. It's named after Yolanda Panic, who was brutally murdered several years ago. And they are greatly concerned because they keep seeing women fleeing danger who have been victims of strangulation.
Sure, Mark. I'd just add to that also dealing with police officers, as you all know, it used to be very common that the chokehold or the carotid artery hold was part of common police practice. It is not anymore because it's too lethal. Too many people had died by accident because police officers had put that hold to sort of contain somebody, and they died. So it is not something that is done as part of a regular use of force continuum, and only in an absolute extreme situation for that very reason.
And that type of hold was different than the actual, usually, you know, supposed to be different than what we're talking about here, but
right.
You're right. Representative Krieger.
This is referring to the male against the female, but more in recent years has been more female
against mail, whether it's drug-induced. And I was looking at this danger assessment here. And does he own a gun? Have you left him? It goes on down. Does he ever try to choke you? He. When almost all of these things, I know for a fact in different cases, clear back to my police days, those same type of things were some vulnerable men. They weren't very physical, and they had a wife that was pretty aggressive. Ever who had the assessment, you ought to send this back and tell her she ought to have he and she and even circle it, because it's not just gender anymore. It's more likely, absolutely, 90%, to women, and we want to protect women. I've got 4 daughters, I have 8 granddaughters, so, you know, I want to protect all of them. But it is he capable of killing you? Women go to killing the male directly faster than men do the female, because that is their out. That is their you know, that's how they get rid of the threat. They don't have much in between a lot of times.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, I was trying to practice.
Case dismissed.
Oh, what do you think this person?
Where's that wastebasket?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I was trying to comply with your hearing with there. I would just say thank you for raising that. This bill would apply to men and women, anyone that is basically putting another person's life at danger, and domestic violence is unacceptable, whether it is perpetrated by a woman or a man.
Yeah, I agree.
And just recently, or a year or so ago, in Portland, there was a hitman went to kill a poor little woman who ended up killing the hitman. So, which was odd on the editorial.
Mr. Chair, now you've been called Your Honor.
Yeah,
you've been called Your Madam.
It's my feminine sideshow, I guess. Ms. Hibb and Mr.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had 2 different questions. So I support the intent of this bill. There are 2 sections in it that I wanted to highlight. So first is in section 4, subsection B, which is the dangerous or deadly weapon. It cites to ORS 161.15, and in this it defines, which defines dangerous weapon as any weapon, device, instrument, etc., material which under the circumstances is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. Now, it's just not apparent to me why strangulation with a pillow is a felony, where strangulation with bare hands is a misdemeanor. And frankly, I think we should seriously consider making it all a felony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I share those concerns. This language was added. It was an amendment to the bill last session where we hadn't addressed any issues at all. What we were concerned about were the cases where there's a baseball bat or some other very dangerous weapon that's not considered usually a weapon that is used to really inflict significant harm upon that individual. I would not oppose making that broader, but I would argue that a pillow in that case could be used as a dangerous or deadly weapon in that case, where generally we don't see a pillow as something like that's dangerous or deadly, like a baseball bat.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
No, I absolutely would. And I think, frankly, I mean, for example, just like assault and battery versus assault and battery with a deadly weapon, a shod foot, i.e. your shoe, in that case, can be used as a deadly weapon. I want to recognize what we're doing, and it's not obvious to me that this all strangulation, whether bare hands or with a pillow or any other weapon, should not be felonious.
Sure. Barker, maybe I can respond really briefly to Representative Barton's question. And, of course, the District Attorney Association would be in agreement with making all of these a felony. And I think the idea was trying to highlight some of the most dangerous. Case law has already identified, when looking at ORS 161.015, that parts of your body are never considered to be a dangerous weapon, but anything else in the manner in which is used, attempt to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing serious physical injury or death, can be a dangerous weapon. And so, as Representative Gelser indicated, it is more likely that if you were to use another object in an effort to strangle somebody, that you would have more weight or power and control over them, and it'd be more likely that you would ultimately kill them than not. Not that you can't kill somebody with your bare hands by any means.
Another question, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, and that is an appropriate distinction. So skipping on now down to line 28, it is strangulation is seen or directly perceived in any other manner by the child. It just struck me as when I read this and reread it that directly perceived is potentially ambiguous and could generate an appellate opinion someday. And if we mean heard, I think we should try and say heard. If we mean something else, but I think it actually will make our lives easier down the road if we clarify it.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, actually that language is directly out of ORS 163-160 for making assault for a felony, mm-hmm. and there's several cases that have come out that have already clarified that exact language for the crime of assault for, and I would assume that that would be interpreted identically under this statute. And that have made that much more narrow, and so it is very clear what that means.
And that would be the intent. We'll make that sure that that is the intent if we pass this legislation. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Harker, Road, Ms. Hebb, please.
I'm going to go to public safety. Do you plan on moving this today?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
We have amendments, Representative Shields, but we will not do those today. Okay, thanks. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center here today, and I want to testify in support of House Bill 2447. I want to really thank the chair as well as Representative Gelzer for her leadership in coming forward with this issue time and time again. It's an important issue to domestic and sexual violence advocates, as you may imagine. The Law Center works very closely with domestic and sexual violence advocates across the state because we see, unfortunately, so many of our low-income clients struggling to escape these dynamics, and we see it keeping them in the cycle of poverty. And so we're committed to helping to address a coordinated community response to those issues. And as part of that, we're supportive of House Bill 2447. We think it's a really well-targeted and narrowly tailored bill that will provide some greater accountability for particularly lethal behavior. I won't echo the quotes or the statistics and the stories that have been shared previously, but I will just add that I think that it is a dynamic that has been seriously under-recognized and minimized, not only by victims of violence, but also by society and some of the responders. There's a lot more training now, and there are experts who have developed who understand that how to identify the signs and how lethal, in fact, the strangulation behavior can be. But we find that there is still minimization. It's referred to as choking quite often, which, you know, I choke sometimes at the dinner table, and that's a whole different dynamic. And really recognizing that and identifying it as a felony in these particularly dangerous and damaging circumstances is the right public policy. And so we appreciate this committee's support of that concept in past sessions and hope that we can continue to move the issue forward. I would also just recognize that or like to indicate that statistics show that 10% of violent deaths in this nation are as a result of strangulation. That's a big number. And so it seems inappropriate to have that behavior titled a misdemeanor and not addressed in a more serious way. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Harker.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. Last August, I tried one of these cases. It went 6 days. It was a domestic violence incident. The most serious charge was assault for in the presence of a child. And the most serious damage was the strangulation that was a misdemeanor. Our doctor testified about the risk of death from the choking. The strangulation and the pressure, and you've all heard the testimony about that. It was somewhat bizarre that the most serious offense was the misdemeanor, and the less serious but not unserious offense was an assault for felony, as well as a criminal mischief, damage to the trailer over $750, and that was a felony. So it was just out of whack. And fortunately, the defendant was convicted of the more serious ones, although less serious in terms of the actual physical injury. It makes sense to move strangulation up, just as we have made assault for felonies in the presence of a child. And this specifically does it, picking up the same language from the assault force statute, and I would encourage you, without saying anything more, except to encourage you to pass this bill. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2447. I have a couple bills to introduce. Bill C's. How about Tuesday? This Monday is a big day. We have two bills, two LCs to adopt today.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wilson,
I move the committee submit as a committee bill LC 594.
Representative Wisnett moves we adopt LC 594. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move that the committee submit as a committee bill LC 621.
Representative Wisnett moves we adopt LC 621 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We have on the agenda House Bill 2331. I'm going to carry that over till Tuesday. Monday is the last day bills can be introduced, so we may be introducing a lot of bills in what we call a tap-tap session. We will recess at 3 o'clock. We will recess the committee, and we'll see, maybe come back at 4:45 that evening if there's more bills out there, so, because that's the last day we can introduce them, so we don't want to leave somebody out if we can.
Okay.
And we'll carry the work session of House Bill 2331 till next Tuesday. No further business before the committee meeting is adjourned.